This is a recording from Jabba. On October 19th, 2007, Jabba hosted a one-day conference called Crafting Intentional Communities, Cooperative Living Along Life's Journey. The event was designed to explore new housing and living innovations for seniors to live, grow, and age in community. This is the fourth in a series of podcasts from that event. This is a panel discussion called Overarching Concepts Applied, and is moderated by Danae Peterson of the Elder Spirit Community.
Well, Marion, why don't we start with you? We'll start with that and just come around and say who you are and what to who your community is.
Hi, I'm Marion Magenia Cobb from Twin Oaks Community, which is out in Louisa County, about 35 miles east of Charlottesville. We call ourselves an intentional community. In the old days, we would be called a commune. We share all our land, our housing, and our income. Everyone works 42 hours a week this year. Each year that quota is adjusted to our economic needs. And but from age 50 up, you get a year off that quota, and it's called pension for each year of your age. So I'm down to about 18 hours a week. We have about 400 acres out in the country. Our work is in three businesses and maintaining ourselves, which means cooking, cleaning, childcare. Children are cared for by primaries who are not just parents but other members of the community. Our businesses are making Twin Oaks hammocks and hanging chairs and tofu and tempeh products and book indexing. And then we have a group that raises ornamentals, someone who raises herbs. So anyone who is knowledgeable and interested in starting a business can often enroll other community members in doing it. The income comes to the community as a whole and goes obviously to pay all the expenses of 100 people. That's 85 adults, 15 kids living on 400 acres. We give ourselves a $70 a month personal allowance, and we charge ourselves 24 cents a mile for driving community cars. So it costs about $17 to come to Charlottesville unless you carpool. So that means we set up group trips, and we do have a tripper system. The community pays for a van to come in on Mondays, Fridays, Wednesdays afternoon, and to bring people to whatever fun or medical appointments they might schedule during those times. Egalitarian, we certainly consider ourselves. Our decisions are made by a planner-manager system where three people do 18 months service as a planner manager. They're not elected, they're selected by the current group of planner managers from those who volunteer who are interested in that position, who want a lot of work and not much recompense, because there's always going to be someone who objects to whatever your decision, so it's not power. You're reminding us of time, Dee.
It is
a time. Okay, so I'll answer questions during that period.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm Monica Appleby. I'm a member of the Elder Spirit Community in Abingdon that Dean told you the story about. But I'm also the director of the Elder Spirit Community Extension Project, which began 2 years ago. We're in our third year. We received a lot of phone calls and a lot of emails and a lot of letters about how do you start an Elder Spirit community, or how do you start a community similar to Elder Spirit. I think there's an attraction in the larger world for this kind of spiritual model of aging that is not just esoteric, but is put in practice. So we started the project, and now we have 11 groups around the country in 5 states, mostly in Virginia and North Carolina, but also in Ohio, Kansas, and Illinois. The group from North Carolina, Carrboro, Chapel Hill is here, and the group from around Richmond, Virginia is here today to support our JABA colleagues, for one thing, and to learn a lot, because more than anything, we're a learning circle where we don't say that Elder Spirit Community in Abingdon is a cookie cutter approach, that it's that there are many ways to build an Elder Spirit Community. They include some of the examples that Zev gave, because in our group we have both urban and rural groups. We have one group that's in the inner city of Cleveland, or East Cleveland. We have groups that are part of organizations or long-term institutions, and groups that are just getting together for the first time. We have groups that have done funding and perhaps not housing itself, but have been experienced fundraisers, and groups who have not done that before, but are more into group spiritual retreat and spiritual development. As Dean said, Drew Leader was our spiritual architect, and we have put together a conceptual model of aging, which we say is a model of mutual support and late life spirituality. Drew talked about late life spirituality, but what we consider another major part of our community efforts, because they're always ongoing, is that of mutual support. And that's a real difference between the model of aging in this country right now. It's not a system of caregiving, but of mutual support. And what we mean by that is that the ability to take care of yourself, to practice yoga, to eat well, to look out for your physical health through walking. And in this conceptual model of aging, which is on a grid and is in this book, this handbook, we refer to it as the holy grid sometimes, but it does look very fixed on a piece of paper. But mutual support is caring for yourself, asking and receiving support, and giving support. So it's a dynamic model. And when we have group get-togethers, we say the hardest part about mutual support is the asking for and the receiving of support, not so much the giving or the receiving of support. So we're trying to, I think our little niche in the aging and community movement is aging in community with spirit and doing it with others that we're learning together about.
I'm Zev, and you've already heard from me.
Hi, I'm Marty Clafe, and I live at Shannon Farm, which is an intentional community in northern Nelson County. I also want to mention an organization that I'm a member of the board of directors of, which is the Fellowship for Intentional Community, which is largely an informational an organization dedicated to dissemination of information about intentional communities. Unfortunately, I didn't bring a directory, and I didn't bring a copy of our magazine, Communities Magazine. Marion has an older version of the directory, but we have a really excellent website, which is www.ic.org, which has information about wide spectrum of information about the whole range of intentional communities that's out there. Shannon Farm has 520 acres in northern Nelson County, We have about 35 households, 58 adult members, and about 25 kids. Our age range is from 1 to 73. In terms of our structure, we're somewhere in between what Marione is describing at Twin Oaks and what Zev and others have described in co-housing. We do not have community businesses. We have private economics. We share the land, the resources of the land, which we are stewards of, and various resources that are on the land. We have a barn, we have tractors, we have roads, we have hay fields, and we manage these through committees. We use a consensus decision-making process. We meet once a month in community meetings. We have once a week community meals. There are no required attendance meetings or activities, so everything is voluntary. We have people who range from being very active in the political life, political if you will, and the decision-making process of the community, and people who don't participate very much, except in a more informal manner, who don't enjoy going to meetings, don't function well in meetings, and we try and take into account the fact that different people operate in different styles. The community's been there for 35 years, maybe 36 or 37, I don't remember. I've been there about 5 years, 6 years. Things move. We share dues as somebody was, I think Dean was talking about, dues to the community. We have a dues system which is based on percentage of income. The people contribute 7% of their after-tax income to dues unless they've been there more than 12 years, and that goes down to 5%. So it comes out to be a very reasonable number and has allowed us to do things like build and maintain our roads, build a lake, build a community center, and basically operate the land. I'll be open to questions.
I'm Carolyn Oley, and I'm here representing Innisfree Village. And Innisfree is a service community located about 20 miles west in Albemarle County. And I arrived there in 1976, just about 5 years after the community began. And the community began a little differently. A group of five families, parents of children with disabilities, looked around at the options available to their children when they grew older. And they had the same fear all parents of children with disabilities have: what will happen when I'm not here to take care of my child? And they weren't satisfied with what they saw, and so they decided to make it happen. And they bought land here in Albemarle County and developed a community without a complete blueprint. They really went flying a bit by the seat of their pants, partially because their vision of what they needed was so clear that the actual details of what it would look like weren't as important in the beginning. We're on 550 acres, 20 miles from here. We have 12 households and their family-style homes. And Innisfree is conceived as a life-sharing community. And what that means is that people who have disabilities live there with other folks whose primary responsibility is living with them. We run a bakery, a weavery, a wood shop, a garden, a greenhouse, a shop on the mall, and all of those are to provide a therapeutic work environment for all of us who choose Innisfree as our home. In addition to the 12 households that are in the rural environment, we have two that are just a half a mile from here, within walking distance of the downtown mall. So though we're a rural environment, we're also an urban environment. And people move fairly frequently and readily between the two. As I listened to the different elements of co-housing, I was interested that many of them were true of us. We're not private homes per se, but we are individual family-style homes. And the people who come to support our co-workers, who typically in another situation might be called residents or clients, are people who come very much looking for a Peace Corps-like experience, perhaps, as I did, for a year. And some of us just don't know when a year is up, I think. Most do come for a year or two, but a lot are still present after 10, 15, and 20 years. There are about 70 people in the community, and the age range is 6 months to 84. So there are children born there, and in the last years, there have certainly been people who die there. Most have been able to stay within their own homes and die with the support sometimes of hospice and sometimes simply of the community itself, those who are life-sharing with them. And it's a miraculous thing to watch somebody go through the decline in their lives and watch the community rally beside. And equally exciting to watch the birth of the new baby in the bathroom because they didn't make it to town. So we've had a lot of events on both ends of the spectrum, and Innisfree's goal really is to be a life-sharing community.
Well, you see, we have lots of variety here, and we're open for questions. Could you repeat the question?
Question was if we have livestock. We have, it's all privately done. Any household can have livestock if they wish to. We may have to petition the community for permission to use the land. Right now there are, I think there's two horses, a donkey and a mule. One couple has a flock of chickens, which they're slowly weeding out. And I just recently got turkeys. And there's lots of cats and dogs. One could say too many dogs, but that's a judgment.
May I answer, too? We also have cattle, but part of our cattle operation is to be a piece of the sustainable agriculture project of our CSA, the Community Supported Agriculture, where people buy subscriptions. So our cattle and chickens are all part of that bigger piece. Yes, sir?
We have several different economic models here. So I was wondering if each of you could tell us about what your requirements are for a financial investment or any other investment, and how you go about the earning of wealth or the gain of equity and the ultimate transfer of equity, or whether equity is all just absorbed and kept within the community.
I'd be glad to go first. We probably have the most unique system. When people sign sales agreement, they put down $2,000 to buy a house, and that gave them the right to choose a house, the location on the property. And our houses sold below market for $90,200 for a 760 square foot one bedroom. And they sold for a 960 square feet two bedrooms, sold for $113,200. Those who bought their houses did upgrades on them. Like they enclosed the deck to be a sunroom, they put in hardwood floors or tile, and they put in fans instead of light fixtures, etc., changed the kitchens a little bit. So all of that was upgrade. And they paid for that on top of the price of the house. And what we did is, in the deeds, these were fee simple purchase. And in the deeds, 50% of the appreciation, after you take the investment in the house plus any improvements, any appreciation, 50% of that would come back to the community at the time of sale. The owner sets their own price for what they want to sell the house for, and they must offer it to people on the waiting list first. So far, we've had four houses to sell, and they've appreciated immensely. One of them, the highest of the 113, but they put a lot of improvements in this house, sold for 163. And that included, we ran out of money to finish the common house, and so all of the owners put added $10,000 to the price of their house to give us the money to finish the common house. And so so they really paid 122 plus improvements. So when they sold it for 163, then half of that appreciation came back to the community. They pay 150 a month for our maintenance fee. Our rents are $300 for a 590 square foot apartment, $300 for a 590 square foot apartment. It has a separate bedroom and bath, so it's not quite an efficiency, but it's not much more than that. For 780 square feet, the renter one bedrooms are bigger than the ownership, which I think is interesting. And they pay $350, and these are all income, 50% area median income. 50% of the area median income, which in our area is a little over $15,000 a year income. And then there's we have 10 of those one bedrooms, and we have 6 two bedrooms, and they rent for $485. And the people who live in those are 80% or about $24,000 a year of income that they can have. And they pay no maintenance. Their maintenance fee comes out of their rent. And even when we needed money for the common house, the renters all agreed that we could put their rent up. But of course, there's a margin on that because it's regulated by the federal government how high the rents could be. We were below what they could be, so we went up $15 a month on every house. The development corporation, Elder Spirit Development Corporation. They some are eligible for those, and then some have enough income that they don't get a subsidy. So that's my answer to your question.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
At Innisfree, there is little accumulation of wealth because people who come there are volunteers to work there. Those who have disabilities pay a monthly tuition to live there. So there's not a lot of money changing hands toward the support of the volunteers who are there. They receive a small monthly stipend, but they also get room and board and have most of their needs covered medically and otherwise. They have use of automobiles, but there's not a shared income per se. The expenses that are paid for by the coworker or the person with a disability's tuition make sure that the buildings, etc., are in good repair. So there's not really a ownership in the same way as in a traditional co-housing model.
So there's no right of inheritance of a property?
No.
When you say inheritance, I'd like to say none of the people who purchased houses minded giving the 50%, but their children did.
Our system is naturally a little different. When Chatham was first founded, one of the values that the founders held was that they didn't want to create real estate deals. So they decided that they would assign values to houses based on square footage and level of finish of the houses. All the houses at Chatham are, well, most of them are built by the people who first lived in them. So there's a range. We have people living on very little money at Chatham, pretty much at subsistence, and we have people who are on the other end of the spectrum, living with relatively high income jobs and very finished houses. Houses generally tend to be smaller than what you'd see outside in society in general. You can't sell your house to somebody who is not a member. One of the differences we have with co-housing is that we have a membership process. So in order to become a member of Shannon, it's largely a social process where you get to know people, people get to know you, and you petition to become a member. You go through a couple of phases of that. And then you become eligible to either build a house on one of the few remaining building sites that we have, or to purchase an available leasehold, which becomes available because people move away. There's a certain amount of turnover. Technically, everything is owned by Shannon, but realistically, the leaseholds are owned by individuals and can be sold to other individuals who are members of Shannon Farm Association. As I said, we control the price of the housing, so you don't really build equity. In fact, if you build a new house using standard construction and standard construction costs, it's a losing financial proposition when you sell it. Because we control the price of the houses, that control of price is going to be below what it costs you to build. We are in the process of reevaluating that as times have changed. We have inflated the value of the houses according to building index over the years, so it hasn't remained constant, but it also hasn't kept up with building costs. There's no buy-in at Shannon. The only way you become a member is through going through the social membership process. So it doesn't cost money to get in. It costs time equity and effort equity in getting to know people. I think I've answered your question.
In co-housing, it varies dramatically from community to community, but I can talk a little bit about ours. It usually takes 3 or 4 months to learn the secret handshake. It's extremely complicated. However, in our community that has 11 households, 7 of the 11 are permanently affordable. So, and that was a requirement by the city. So 3 of them are for people that make a maximum of 60% of the area median income. 4 are for people in the 80 to 120%, and 4 a market rate. So as you might imagine, we have an extremely varied price range. For example, right now, the price range is probably between $120,000 and over $600,000. The homes that are permanently affordable, there's an income cap in terms of who can qualify. There's a sales cap determined by the city, and there is an appreciation cap, which is, I think right now it's a guaranteed 1% per year and a maximum of about 3%. And the market rate homes can do whatever they want. So it really, it's a good example of how varied it can be, even within the community. So you buy your house the way you normally would, and then you just have to agree to a variety of things, including paying your monthly dues, which in our community vary from about $130 a month to $330 a month.
And I'll just ditto what Dean said about Elder Spirit Community in Abingdon. In the groups that are in the extension project, they have not yet got to that point of even buying land, so they haven't figured out their economic relationships. But as in all co-housing, they're looking at private homes and common space.
At Twin Oaks Community, there's no charge for joining and for residing there. I mentioned the monthly allowance. Every member gets their own room in one of the 7 residences. There is a membership process. People apply for a 3-week visitor program where they have orientations to various aspects of the community and learn to make hammocks and do other jobs, make tofu. If their presence is acceptable to the community and they are interested, they can come back after a month and join. Their bank accounts are put on hold Well, actually, the community would get the interest on those accounts and stocks and bonds, but members do not have the use of those communities. We have an egalitarian income system, so people live within provisions made by the community, which is complete room, board, various activities funded by the community, and whatever candy, cigarettes, and whatever you want to buy with your $70 a month allowance. But your bank accounts are somewhere else on hold, except for interest that that comes to the community. For that 3-week visitor program, we ask $50 to $250 fee. And members who, like myself, who receive Social Security, others who might get SSI, that is donated to the community. And I also wanted to add that we have 30 cows, numerous chickens, geese, and a quota for dogs and cats. 5 dogs, 10 cats.
Okay. Very good. Yes. You. Right there. You. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so I will not remember all those questions, so I'm glad you have them written down. But one of them is, describe the common house. I'll start there. I remember the last one. Our common house is about 2,000 square feet. On the first floor, we have a large dining room, a multi-purpose room that just has a concrete floor, it's unfinished, a kitchen, a pantry, a mechanical room for the building, another mechanical room for an elevator. We're in the mountains, and so we had to build the first floor into the mountain and the second floor on top of that at another level for the road, and an office, a laundry room, although every house has hookups if they want to buy their own washer and dryer, and a lounge. And on the second floor, we have studio space. And that's a rather large room. We have 2 guest rooms with a bath in between. We have another lounge up there that's adjacent to a small library. And so you have like a reading room plus a lounge that's adjacent to that. And then attached to the common house, which I will never, ever, ever do again because the fire regulations almost broke the bank for me, was 4 apartments are at the upper level of the common house, the 4 590 units. But the fire regulations really made us build non-inflammatory construction materials. So we used cement block. We did put a stone face on it, so it's a little bit dressy, but it's not very dressy. And we had to put ceilings, fireproof ceilings all over, all under, on the first floor, because we had people living on the second floor. So don't ever put residents in your common house, is what my recommend. And we had to have 2 stairwells, 2-way out in case of a fire. So we have 1/3 of this building looks like it's in stairwells and elevators. I mean, it's not the, we don't have the best design yet, but we're going to do better next time. And how many couples do we have? We have 5 couples, maybe 6, 5 or 6 couples. We have 3 single men and the rest are single women. And that's pretty par for an elder community. And we have 42 people in all in our 29 houses we built, plus there's 2 apartments in a house adjacent to us that's part of the community. And how long is the waiting list? The waiting list, it was 63, 19 of whom were low-income people. at the last time we looked. And out of that waiting list, probably less than one-third would actually end up coming. Because it's easy to get on a waiting list. You pay $20, you become, you know, you get on a waiting list and you can stay there. And so my guess is about one-third of the waiting list would actually come to the community. When you sign the sales agreement to buy a house, or by that time you're under construction. See, we're building a second community in Abington because of the waiting list. And so that what... we don't take sales agreement on houses until we start construction. We have a plan for a house and we start construction, then we feel like it's safe to say, yes, this house will be complete. Pets, we allow people who have two pets to bring two with them, and if the one dies, we ask them not to replace it. If they have one pet and that pet dies, they can replace it if they want to. The co-support we do the same as these other communities do. We have committees, and the kind of so that the work includes like landscape, common meals, environment, property management, etc., etc. I think we have 12 committees in all. Yes, yeah, and then we have the mutual support, as Monica described it. It's also some caregiving. Like one person broke her shoulder when she came home from the hospitals. Instead of going to a place for physical therapy, she came home. The physical therapist came to the house, and then we helped her to get dressed and have breakfast every morning. She was one of our renters, was eligible for Meals on Wheels. She didn't want to be a burden, which was nice, and took Meals on Wheels for her other two meals until she could cook. Oh, we're about two blocks from downtown Abington. Okay, I'll take you. I'll come over there next. Stand up and talk loud. Okay, we'll give that one to Zev and Monica and me. I mean, we'll all have different ideas.
There are a couple of examples of co-housing neighborhoods that are retrofit. The first one is called N Street, and that's in Davis, California. And it's been around about as long as the traditional co-housing is, and just built over time, where they just bought up houses over time and had people move in who wanted more of a close-knit neighborhood, and then eventually they tore down the fences in the backyard, and then eventually they collaborated and bought one of the homes together and used that as their common house, and they actually just renovated it so that it works even better for that. There's a book out on the in the bookstore called Superbia, and it says 31 things you can do to help build community in your neighborhood. And it talks about things as simple as having informal potlucks on a regular basis, all the way through what I just described in terms of, you know, getting tearing down the fences and really creating more of a collaborative. And I'd be happy to talk to you more about that, because that's really something close to my heart. I feel like we have to do a lot of that since we have so much already built.
In one of the extension projects for Elder Spirit, it's based in Burnsville, North Carolina, in and around the CeeLo community, which is a long time founded by Adams, who started the TVA. It's a Quaker-based community, and they decided that they would create a neighborhood, not just in their own community of CeeLo, but in the whole county, that would have support systems for elderly people. and it may or may not include the building of a building, but they're basing it on the NORC idea, which is naturally occurring retirement communities, and the work that's being done in Beacon Hill in Boston, Massachusetts. So there's a lot going on about making your neighborhood work for you when you're older. But it's not easy to do.
Right. Okay, I'm going to take you. Your first question, the spiritual aspect. It's beginning to take hold. Let's just say like that. We've been there about a year, and some of us maybe a year and a half, but the community on the whole is about 1 year old. And so if you have people above 60, we're from 63 to 83 in the community, moving and so forth, it takes us a while to unstress from such a transition. And the practices that are going on now are, we have a meditation group, we have a prayer group, we have another group that's doing Thomas Merton spirituality, Thomas Merton study group, so to speak. And then I think community living demands a certain amount of spirituality. You're bound to grow as you and get some rough edges rubbed off as you meet shoulder to shoulder with each other. And so I think community itself is spiritual. And we have on November the 4th, we're going to dedicate our spirit center, which is a 500 square foot separate building for activities. And then we have yoga and
we also consider, like Drew Leader said, that community service and work in the community, taking care of ourself and our neighbors, the creative life, inner work, I'm naming the values, and reverence for the earth are all part of our spirituality. So when we wanted to take the practices in real life and off the grid, we had a workshop in which people named the various spiritual practices they were doing currently. And then an artist in our group and a committee that I'm on put together an image, and to exemplify it. And it's a tree with roots and trunk and branches. And then on the leaves are the various practices. And when we have our dedication of the Common House, we're going to use that image as part of a ritual in our dedication. So we're working on it.
Okay.
I could address your second question about environmental. Most of our houses were started almost 30 years ago, so awareness and consciousness has changed a lot. We have 3 houses that are partial to fully solar paneled, and we have traditionally had a community-supported fund for being off-grid. The community supports water systems and roads, and that fund was created especially to support solar energy. We also have just begun in the past year to take our 520 acres and design it. We've always had about 10-15% set aside as reserve, and our housing is arranged in clusters, basically up in the hills, where most of it is up in the hills and not obtrusive to the landscape and built in pretty well. And we've just recently started looking at the farm as a whole and in different parts and seeing how we want to develop each one in a sustainable manner and in a food-producing manner, if we can do that as well.
Well, what we do with sustainability is we tried to build green and couldn't afford it, but we do have passive solar, and that's made a huge difference. We put all of our big windows on the south side, all our little windows on the north side. So we like the idea of it, and we do recycling, composting, in terms of cars, we carpool a whole lot. We never organized that. It just happened that people going to the college for older adults, the people going to church, the people going to concerts, we're all going to the same thing, so we just go together. And we did that without it. We figure we use a car at least 50% less than people in condo units would use a car. Yes. Can you talk louder?
To come to Innisfree or to start your own?
No.
To come to Innisfree. The first is, of course, a tour with the son or the daughter that is a potential member of the community, and determining mutually whether it looks like a fit. Then there's a multi-step process of a two-week visit, and then subsequently, if that looks positive, then a six-month trial period. We're full. We have a waiting list as well, and we don't have a lot of turnover. People don't leave very often. More often that the openings are caused by the death of one of our other members. So only one or two new people come each year.
Minutes. Yes.
I'll comment just briefly on your last question. It's exactly like the decision that took place in my own family about my mother. Every few weeks we'd say, can we do this? And we said yes, and we said yes. And then we began to question, and by chance she died. It was exactly the same process with each coworker at Innisfree who has died. We have turned to each other and said, can we still do this if the physical care becomes great? So we're not utopic. We are real families, not genetic families, but real families struggling with those decisions. With the help of hospice, it's been much easier, but we also are a care community. Our whole focus is caring for one another, probably more strongly than anyone else represented here. So it's a very natural fit, but it is not easy. One of my favorite memories is sitting with Judith before she died, and I arrived with my knitting ready to sit there, and there was Wes and Nancy, and I said, wait, this is my time. And they said, well, we're here too. It's our time. And we were fighting over the opportunity to sit with her because it was where it was happening in our community. It was developing that center of energy, that it wasn't a hidden away place or a negative place. It was where the music was. It was where everybody was coming. And that was kind of a natural extension for us, but still not easy. And not in absolutely every case have we been able to keep people.
I'd like to answer that for Elder Spirit. We don't know the answer in the community, but we had the experience of one of the focus members dying, and she was living in one of the apartments on the hill. And we formed a care committee, and it was the five people who lived around there. And so we got a wireless doorbell for $5, I think it was, and you can get as many little bells as you want. So she had four bells in her house that rang in the other apartment when she needed help. She had arthritis and ended up with congenital heart failure. And so this was, and so the arthritis meant she would fall. She also had macular degeneration, so she could see but not well. And then she had some heart trouble. The care committee was this. Catherine would answer the doorbell. She worked at home and lived in the adjacent apartment. And then I went there. I was working doing the Elder Spirit. I went there every day from 4 to 6, which meant that Catherine and Kathy, who lived with Catherine, could go out and be away. And then she had me to take care of her mail, And then we would read or pray or do whatever she wanted to do. I was better at reading than praying, I think. And then Anne, who lived 45 minutes away but stayed overnight once a week, well, she trimmed Lenore's nails and helped her to make phone calls to her family and friends. And then we had Jean Marie, and Jean Marie didn't like to be struck. Oh, I was her medical power of attorney, and so every time Lenore went to the doctor, I went with her so that we could talk about what the doctor said when she came back. And when any time any of us couldn't do what we usually did, Jean Marie was the pinch hitter for us. And then we had Kathy, who had, to me, has very little bedside manner. And so what Kathy did, Lenore got very sick at the last month of her life. Kathy emailed Lenore's friends every day. She came from Knoxville to Abington and told them every day what was going on with Lenore. And 30 of those people came and visited Lenore carrying her favorite dish to eat the last month of her life. And it was, I mean, it was not hard on any of us the way that we did it. And one time Anne said, there's two little stories with this. Anne said to Catherine, well, Lenore's feeling better. Maybe I shouldn't come. And Catherine said, no, Lenore needs someone to visit. All I do is go in and do what she needs to have done. I don't spend time enough. And so she told Anne, if she wasn't needed, she was needed. And then the other thing, Lenore came to one of the care committee meetings, and we said, well, how are things working for you? And she was hiring a housekeeper to come in once a week. And so she said, I like to have somebody I can boss around once a week. Because we were friends and she wasn't bossing us. And so that was an example for me of kind of like, it made me believe Elder Spirit would work. And we have a care committee in the community, and when someone needs help, they tell the care committee what they need, and the care committee gets volunteers to do what needed to be done. And we tell everyone when they come in that we can't do everything for everybody, that they will probably have to buy home health care and some housekeeping service. But our ideal is for people to be able to die at home.
I have a question about waiting lists. For those of you who keep waiting lists, what's the youngest age of prospects seeking future entry? And how large is your waiting list? And would you see the prospects of replicating your community elsewhere, or seeding it, or growing it where it is with more units?
Well, we're building another one because of our waiting list, but we're building a whole separate community. We don't want to grow the one we have because we already have 30 homes there with 42 people, and that's a pretty good human size, I think. And so we don't want to grow it, so we're doing an entirely separate community. And the age, I don't know, I had somebody 51 ask if they could go on the waiting list, and I had someone 55 come in to join this community, and I questioned whether somebody almost 15 years younger than the youngest person in the community really wanted to live there. She ended up not coming, but I thought she had to really think about that. She said, well, I've worked with old people my whole life, I like them. And I said, but it's not living with them, you know. And so that was my take on it, but that was just me. And I don't know the age. There's some people that don't get on the waiting list because they're up in their 80s and they don't think they'll last that long.
There are not nearly enough wonderful places for people with disabilities to live, so I hope there will be many more. And I think the life-sharing model provides a really viable alternative for them. Our waiting list is a few years long. It doesn't turn over regularly. I think probably we're different in that the folks coming in who have disabilities are between 21 and 35. We do not want to all be old at the same time. We purposefully want to have young people and old people, and so are much more of an intergenerational model.
Monica, you want to talk about the extension?
No, I think it's time.
Oh. Karen is here. Woo-hoo.
I was trying to be. Well, lunch is here is the more important part.